The impeachment trial could be nearing its final stages, and President Trump's lawyers are offering an unprecedented case for executive power.
By this logic, Watergate was not an impeachable offense because it was done to help Nixon win re-election.
I'm Arun Vandegopal, and today on The Takeaway for January 30th, we break down the arguments that both sides are presenting in the trial. Also on the show, we take a look into the controversial Border Patrol Explorers program that's targeting kids as young as 14 years old.
The Border Patrol for quite a while now has operated with near impunity.
Plus, a look at Brexit's next steps and how the Me Too movement is making its way into a number of new movies. We start on Capitol Hill. Let's go.
Mr. Chief Justice, I send a question to the desk.
The chair will operate on a rebuttable presumption that each question can be fully and fairly answered in 5 minutes or less, end quote. The transcript indicates that the statement was met with, quote, laughter, end quote.
Is that going to be the new norm for impeachment? You put an impeachment together in a couple of weeks, we don't like what the president did, we wrap it up and we send it up here and say, now go figure it out.
A corrupt Ukrainian oligarch who was paying our vice president's son and his son's business partner millions of dollars.
Let us stay focused. This doesn't have anything to do with president's children or the Biden's children. This is about the president's wrongdoing.
Withheld that official act to solicit foreign interference in a 2020 election. That is not acceptable in America.
What did Mulvaney mean when he said quid pro quo? What did Bolton mean when he said drug deal?
If we call John Bolton, I promise you we're calling Hunter Biden too.
Even if everything in Bolton's book happens to be true, I still do not believe that that rises to the level of the impeachable offenses that the House has charged the president with.
It would be absurd to have the Senate trying to consider, well, was it 48% legitimate interest and 52% personal interest, or was it the other way? Was it 53% and 46%? You can't divide it that way.
A new phase in President Trump's impeachment trial has begun. Yesterday, senators began questioning House managers and President Trump's attorneys about the president's contact with Ukraine. Congressman Schiff led the House managers.
This body should not accept, nor should the American people accept, the idea put out by the president's lawyers today that it is perfectly fine, unimpeachable, for a president of the United States to say, hey, Russia, or hey, Ukraine, or hey, China, I want your help in my election.
Meanwhile, the president's attorney, Alan Dershowitz, made his case as to why a quid pro quo in this case would not be an impeachable offense.
If a president does something which he believes will help him get elected in the public interest, that cannot be the kind of quid pro quo that results in impeachment.
In other words, if the president wants it, he should just have it. That's as diplomatic a take as I can offer. You've been watching this whole spectacle along with us. We asked you to weigh in on what you've seen so far in the trial and what questions you have.
Hi, this is Barry from Minneapolis. How is it possible that our senators are even arguing about whether to call witnesses? Really? Even TV trials have witnesses. If you don't want to hear what the witnesses have to offer for evidence, please just stick your fingers in your ears.
Hi, this is Dave Gill from Seattle. My question is, why can't the Chief Justice intervene and impose standard rules such as allowing witnesses and evidence? Why is the Chief Justice even there if he's not actually presiding?
This is Reagan from Omaha, and I am wondering why in the beginning of every session of Congress that I have listened to during the impeachment, there is a Christian prayer said. My understanding is that we do not have an official religion, and there is a separation of church and state. So why is this read out? Why aren't all prayers read out or none?
For some answers to all that and analysis of this last week in impeachment, we go back to Max Kuttner, a journalist covering impeachment, Russia probes, the FBI, and the Justice Department, as well as Amanda Turkel, Washington Bureau Chief at the Huffington Post. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Amanda, you heard that unbelievable statement by Alan Dershowitz. It's hard to overstate how blatantly self-serving this argument is, isn't it?
It's an incredible argument. I mean, it's so incredible that a lot of Republican senators afterward were not even going there. They were not willing to say that they supported it or embraced it. But essentially, you're saying that the president can do almost anything as long as he believes that if it helps his reelection, as long as he believes that it's in the public interest. And Trump believes that the public interest lies in him getting elected. Therefore, the president can do almost anything. It's a mind-boggling argument.
That's interesting. So, Max, you're also seeing Republicans distancing themselves from the Dershowitz defense.
Absolutely. As Amanda said, Republicans, even Republicans, aren't agreeing with this. They're distancing themselves. Certainly, constitutional law scholars like Neil Katyal are distancing themselves and saying this doesn't make a whole lot of sense to them and scratching their heads. This morning, I saw the hashtag Dershowitz logic was trending in obviously a sarcastic way. So this argument didn't make sense to a lot of people. And even by this logic, Watergate was not an impeachable offense because it was done to help Nixon win re-election. So this left a lot of people scratching their heads.
Amanda, how would you characterize the arguments we've been hearing from the president's defense team overall?
Well, it's interesting. They've changed. And I think they've changed in part because of John Bolton, who's just thrown a wrench in this sort of what was supposed to be this smooth acquittal of Trump is what Republicans were hoping. You know, for so long, we heard Republicans say there was no quid pro quo. And now it's changing a little bit. And you're hearing essentially, well, if there was quid pro quo, so what?
What's wrong with quid pro quo?
Exactly. You have the Dershowitz argument, but then you even have arguments that stop short of that, saying, look, the president didn't really do anything wrong. It's not like it's unconstitutional. It's not like he's breaking a law or there's no crime. So, you know, this is just sort of vague and fuzzy. There's not enough there. But you're not hearing them say the famous no quid pro quo line quite as much anymore.
Max, tomorrow is the big day in the trial, right?
Yeah, this could be a historic day. This is when the witness vote will happen. And of course, it would actually be unprecedented to not have new witnesses. In the Andrew Johnson impeachment, there were 36 new witnesses called.
Going back to the 19th century here? Mm-hmm.
Of course. In the Clinton impeachment, there were 3 new witnesses called, including Monica Lewinsky. Mm. And so the Trump lawyers' argument earlier this week that the Senate shouldn't be litigating what the House didn't do and doing the work that the House didn't do and calling new witnesses, that doesn't really hold up. It would actually be unprecedented to not have new witnesses.
Now, Max, John Bolton's forthcoming book has really solidified his role in the trial as someone who could help the Democrats with their arguments. Break down for us some of what's in this manuscript and how it could be used.
So the manuscript says that Trump told him that he would only release the money to Ukraine if Ukraine announced investigations into Biden. This is the quid pro quo that we've been hearing from other witnesses, but all of that was secondhand or third hand. And that's a point that Trump's lawyers have made. This is secondhand and third hand. So the Bolton book would change that. The Bolton book says that this was firsthand knowledge. And so for that reason, Democrats really want to hear from him, and for that reason, Republicans don't want to hear from him, among other reasons.
Amanda, how are they saying, or how are they dismissing the validity of the John Bolton, testimony?
I mean, it's really funny. You have Democrats on one side sort of arguing about the facts of the impeachment case, and you have Republicans on the other side essentially saying, we don't even want to know the facts. You know, Republicans have been saying, like, look, we haven't seen the manuscript. This is just news reports based on the manuscript. So we want to see the manuscript. So the question is, well, why don't you just ask John Bolton, since he wrote the book himself, why don't you just call him and ask him questions yourself? And they're saying, well, look, we don't know if he's a relevant witness yet, so because we haven't seen the manuscript. So they're thinking of all the ways possible that they can get out of actually calling John Bolton and questioning him. Obviously, he's a relevant witness. He was national security advisor. He had direct conversations with the president. You've had these other witnesses testify that they believe Bolton knew what was going on and would have relevant information. You have the manuscript, which reportedly says that Bolton had direct knowledge and that Trump told him that the money was being held up because of these investigations, including into the Bidens. John Bolton is a relevant witness. Republicans know that, which is why they don't want to call him, because he could have very damaging information.
Amanda, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said yesterday that he doesn't think he has the votes from Republicans to call witnesses. What are you hearing from Republican senators who at one point did seem open to calling witnesses?
Yeah, it's looking dire for witnesses. One sort of shot yesterday was Senator Cory Gardner from Colorado, who is considered a possible vote for witnesses because he's in a more moderate state and he's up for re-election. But yesterday he said that he didn't want to, he didn't think witnesses were needed. And Schumer admitted that it's going to now be tough to get four Republicans to side with calling witnesses, which looks good for Mitch McConnell. And there's even, I saw a report in Axios that there was some speculation that maybe Mitch McConnell, when he said that he didn't think he had the votes to block witnesses, you know, he knew that would leak to the press. It was a way to get Republicans anxious and get them to start coming out and saying they don't want witnesses. So there is a very good chance that this will be an impeachment trial where the Senate, you know, they say they're a jury and they don't actually hear from any new witnesses.
Max, is it clear what kind of pressure is being brought to bear on these sort of middle of the road Republican senators?
Well, there's a lot of pressure from Democrats. The line that we were hearing from people like Chuck Schumer in recent days has been that they'll have to answer to their voters. That's kind of the angle that they're taking. But, you know, as Amanda said, this has changed throughout the week, with first Republicans saying that they weren't confident that they had the votes. Now they're saying they do. Schumer is saying it's not more likely than not. So tomorrow, if the motions don't carry tomorrow, this could move on to acquittal. But there are a handful of it only takes four Republican votes to get that witness motion to carry.
But what kind of pressure are they getting from the right?
Well, I think that they're getting pressure from the right, certainly to stick with the Republicans and to not, you know, side with the Democrats on this. And you are having a lot of Republican lawmakers tweeting out and talking to reporters and saying that it's really time to move on from this, and that to drag it out with witnesses would not be in anyone's benefit. Certainly, President Trump has a reason to get this over with New Hampshire Democratic primary next week, with State of the Union next week, and Iowa caucuses next week.
Amanda, real quick, there were some question cards that senators were submitting to Chief Justice Roberts. Has this process of questioning even provided anything of substance during this impeachment process?
For the most part, no. But I would say the most substantive questions have come from those senators who are sort of more on the line: Mitt Romney, Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski. Those questions actually have produced new information and sort of revealing stuff.
Amanda Turkle is the Washington bureau chief at the HuffPost, and Max Kuttner is a journalist covering impeachment, Russia probes, the FBI, and the Justice Department. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For nearly 100 years, the U.S. Border Patrol has been tasked with catching migrants attempting to cross into the United States. The agency, which operates under the Department of Homeland Security, can search and detain people without a warrant if they suspect someone is undocumented or is smuggling contraband.
The Border Patrol, for quite a while now, has operated with near impunity.
That's Greg Grandin, a history professor at Yale University and author of The End of the Myth, From the Frontier to the Border Wall in the Mind of America. Despite this lack of scrutiny, the agency has for decades operated a program called the Border Patrol Explorers, which teaches teenagers age 14 to 18 to carry out Border Patrol enforcement work. Morley Music, a freelance reporter, recently wrote a feature story for The Nation about the training program, raising questions about the tactics and philosophy underlying the Explorers program. I sat down with Greg and Morley to discuss this program and the broader history of the biggest law enforcement agency in the country. I began by asking Morley where this program takes place.
This happens in border communities, both along the southern and northern border. So Arizona, Texas, California, also Detroit, Maine, and Washington.
So there's a wide range of activities that these teenagers sort of participate in. Can you give me a sense of some of them?
So because the work, you know, consists of basically learning how to be an agent, they role play various scenarios that agents might encounter. One of these is a high-risk vehicle stop, which would be stopping a car on a highway. And then the others are apprehending people crossing through the desert. So some of the situations consist of splitting the kids into agents and role play undocumented people. And they tell the kids, okay, you know, you guys are going to go off and hide, and the agents are going to go track down your footprints and catch you. And this time there's going to be an altercation, or this time there won't be, or this time you guys are going to fire at the agents, or this time they'll fire at you.
And strikingly, many of these young people who are joining this program are themselves the sons and daughters of immigrants, including undocumented immigrants, correct?
That's right, yeah.
Greg, part of the experience for these young men and women involves learning the history of the Border Patrol. I'm curious, if you were their instructor, yeah, what would you be telling them about that history?
The Border Patrol was created in 1924. And prior to that, the border was more or less open. The agency was very small at first. It just had a few hundred agents. But it quickly acquired a reputation for brutality. In many ways, the Border Patrol was compensation. 1924 was also the year that the U.S. Congress passed the famous Immigration Act, which put quotas on basically lowered immigration from Asia to zero, and gave privilege to immigrants from Northern Europe, from Protestant Europe. But Mexico was exempt. Mexico had no quotas because the large ranches and the miners, the corporations on the border wanted cheap labor. So in some ways, the Border Patrol was compensation to the nativists who felt that they didn't get what they wanted with that immigration law when it came to Mexico and when it came to Latin America.
So how has the agency changed in the nearly 100 years since it was created?
Well, it grew quickly, and there was a qualitative leap. In the 1930s, there was a big push for deportations, as there was in the 1950s. It's larger than all other federal agencies put together, and it's one of the most well-funded. So it's grown exponentially over the last years at these key moments, the 1930s, the 1950s, and then again in the 1990s.
To your knowledge, has it had an active recruitment effort among young people, such as the ones that Morley has reported on?
No, that Morley story to me was eye-opening. It was chilling.
And why is that?
I think it speaks to the larger militarization of the country. And when you think about other law enforcement agencies, you think about the CIA or the FBI, they all had moments of reckoning at different times, mostly in the 1970s, 1980s, when they had to deal with acknowledging abusive patterns of repression of people of color and social movements. For the most part, the Border Patrol has operated without any accountability. Its pattern of abuse has been documented by reporters, but for the most part, it's largely been held unaccountable. And so when you see this recruitment and the sensationalizing of interdiction of human beings, particularly when one thinks of how many people have died crossing the desert trying to get in the United States, then nobody knows the number, but some have calculated about 10,000 people have died since the 1990s alone.
Morley, you point out that many other sort of agencies, police departments and the like, do have, say, cadet programs. So what's so special or different about the Border Patrol Explorers?
I think what's special about it is just the nature of the work. Police and military explorer programs, of which there are many, the work is about arresting immigrants crossing through the desert, and the kind of training that the explorers receive is tuned to the geography of the region that they're in. So I talked to some kids who were taken by their agents to the Rio Grande River, where the agents pointed out men who they alleged were pretending to fish but were really scouts for the cartel. And in Maine, the kids, you know, were taken around in radar boats.
Now, you said this is happening along the border, both the southern and northern border. Is there a sense of the scale of this?
Yeah, it's as of 2018, I think there are 890 kids in the program. They're mostly in Arizona and Texas, but also in California.
So walk us through what communities along the border are like and what the general makeup of the Border Patrol Explorer program, what it looks like.
I was reporting in Arizona and a little bit in Texas, and the communities I was in, Ajo, Douglas, and Laredo, are primarily Hispanic. And I think there's a lot of reasons for that, but one of them is that sometimes people move down there because it's the easiest way to be close to relatives that are in Mexico. Or say if you've had a parent or someone else who's been deported, it's a way to sort of keep your family together as you can move to a town like Douglas and just kind of drive across every day or every week. So just sort of reflecting the makeup of the communities, the Border Patrol explorers along the southern border is majority Hispanic.
Did you sense any sort of ambivalence, or were these kids, these teenagers, pretty excited or gung-ho about participating in these kinds of exercises?
For the most part, they're excited. And I think that has a lot to do with the fact that the exercises are actually seem kind of fun. The kids sort of get to play cops and robbers and run around with fake guns and that kind of thing. I did talk to one graduate of the Explorers who had nothing but good things to say about the program itself, but had opted not to join the Border Patrol and instead was working within the Sheriff's Department in Douglas, Arizona. But even his effort at sort of avoiding what I think he considered some of the more unsavory sides of Border Patrol work hadn't really succeeded, because he was working in the jail, which was used as a holding center for immigrants. A lot of kids who join the program also don't explicitly aim at joining the Border Patrol. A lot of them do it because the training is sort of viewed as good prep for the military, which in itself raises some questions.
And certainly its recruitment efforts feel similar to the kinds of, trailers we see for the military, the movie trailers you might see sitting down at a movie in a movie theater or watching on TV. I want to play a clip for you of a video similar to one that you mentioned in your reporting. Here's an ad for the Chandler Tactical Competition, which features different youth law enforcement groups, including the Border Patrol Explorers. This ad is layered with clips from a Mission Impossible movie. In this video, you see a lot of kids. Some of them are brown, presumably Latinx kids, running around with fake guns.
Your mission, should you choose to accept it.
All right, guys, go.
It's all irrelevant.
Hey, don't you make that.
So you see all these young people sort of like bursting into rooms where they're sort of like taking down presumably an immigrant. It feels very, I guess you could say, exciting if you're into that kind of a thing. You are familiar with this competition. What can you tell us about this and what it says about the broader philosophy of the program?
Well, the competitions are run in these sort of mock war zone like spaces in Chandler, Arizona, which I believe they also use to train local law enforcement. And they include a series of events that are supposed to be, I guess, the kind of things that they'll encounter in law enforcement, although they have a decidedly warlike tinge. So there's saving hostages, there's marijuana field raid competitions, there's, I guess, capturing terrorists. I think since 9/11, this has become a bigger part of Explorer curriculums is counterterrorism kind of stuff. I think the competitions sort of deal in a few dangerous insinuations. The first being just that law enforcement work can in any way be likened to a competition. I really don't think that's the sort of right suggestion, however lighthearted it might be. The second is that it is law enforcement work is like military work, is interchangeable sort of preparation, that the kids are moving in war zones and the villains, you know, wear sort of Arab, they wear keffiyehs and they diffuse bombs where in an earlier trailer you can see the kids diffusing a bomb with a cell phone call written in Arabic. There's strong suggestions in these photographs that the kids are moving through sort of, you know, Middle East spaces, but they're domestic, you know, Border Patrol explorers. So the suggestion is, okay, border enforcement is somehow like wars in the Middle East, and then wars in the Middle East are like Bond movies or Mission Impossible.
Or taking down the terrorist.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Greg.
I was just going to say the irony of this, of course, is that more than any other law enforcement agency, the Border Patrolling has been subject to high-tech technology, the deployment of high-tech sensors and surveillance that has actually rendered the actual work of the Border Patrol quite mundane. So there's a real dissonance between the action of that recruitment clip and what is the everyday experience of Border Patrolling. Just to go back to the desert scene, you know, the crossing through the desert is a relatively new phenomenon, just a couple of decades old. Prior to the 1990s, the vast majority of migrants who crossed back and forth did cross relatively safe urban crossings in El Paso and Brownsville. It was during the Clinton administration that they began to militarize all of those relatively safe crossing and forcing migrants out into the desert. And they intentionally did this as a deterrent. They talked about geography would slow down migration. That's not what happened. What happened was that it stopped a pattern of being able to go back and forth and do seasonal migration work. And once you got into the United States, you stayed here because the cost of crossing was so high. But the result of it was just to create an incredibly onerous trek through some of the most dangerous and deadly terrain in the hemisphere in the world. And it is very warlike. And the other thing that I would say is that it's well documented. Groups like No More Death have documented the degrees in which the Border Patrol actually sabotage attempts to do humanitarian work for the migrants. They puncture water bottles. They destroy food left out to help migrants. So there is this – I know there is this recruitment notion that they're doing humanitarian work, and in some ways that's how the dissonance is worked out among Latinos who join the Border Patrol. But the fact of the matter is that they often are quite – you know, there is this heritage of brutality that has carried forth – directed at migrants. And this kind of conflation of foreign war and border patrolling continues that brutality and it's a form of terrorism.
Greg, there's an excerpt in Morley's piece where he asks someone who participates in the program, he says why he continues to participate in it. Presumably this is a border patrol explorers, but and the answer, he says, is money. He replied, money, money, money. Ajo's median household income is just over $33,000, and just under a third of its residents live below the federal poverty line. When the highest paying jobs in town are in law enforcement, working for Border Patrol makes economic sense. So we're looking at really a pipeline of young brown people who are in ways being drawn to something where they'll be policing their own communities. Am I right?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And it is a kind of pipeline of desperation. I mean, look, the first three fatalities in the war in Iraq from the U.S. were two undocumented Mexicans and an undocumented Guatemalan. So there's ways in which, you know, there's this cycle of desperation that has wheels within wheels. It has to do with economic policy in Central America and Mexico, which creates the conditions of desperation that forces the migration. It has to do with the militarization of the border, which makes it incredibly perilous. And then it has to do with the desperation that once people are here, one of the only growth industries for some of the migrants is law enforcement or the military.
I do want to add an important caveat is that sometimes Mexican Border Patrol agents or just descendants of Mexican immigrants along the border really don't identify with the most recent wave of immigrants, and that I had sort of presupposed that as a Mexican immigrant, you would, you know, feel some solidarity with the more recent waves of crossing, but sometimes there's really strong efforts to, say, distance yourself from Guatemalans or Salvadorians.
Morley Music is a freelance reporter, and Greg Grandin is a history professor at Yale University and author of The End of the Myth, From the Frontier to the Border Wall in the Mind of America. Morley and Greg, thank you so much for joining me.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
What you just heard were members of the European Parliament standing up, holding hands, and singing Auld Lang Syne, a traditional British New Year's Eve song, after voting overwhelmingly to ratify the Brexit withdrawal agreement, which will officially begin at 11 p.m. on Friday, Greenwich Mean Time. While much of the rhetoric around Brexit has been about isolationism and controlling immigration, the split also means that Britain has to create new trade agreements with countries around the world. One big priority will be the trade agreement between the UK and the US. For more on this, I'm joined by Yasmin Serhan, London-based staff writer at The Atlantic. Welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me, Arun.
Yasmin, there was a long stretch there where it seemed like there would never be a formal deal and we'd be stuck in some sort of eternal Brexit limbo, and now it's actually happening. What's the mood like?
Yeah, indeed. It's hard to believe years on that this day is finally arriving. The mood is actually a bit strange, I must say. I think, you know, there have been so many cliff edges, so many different Brexit days. As you recall, we had March 29th, then we had October 31st, and now we have this new date that, you know, I think after the election happened, that was kind of when it sort of sunk into everyone, like, okay, this is actually going to happen. And now, as a result, things are kind of quiet. I don't think there's as much anticipation now. I think people have sort of just resigned themselves.
Earlier, there were some doomsday scenarios in terms of the impact on the British economy. Is that still the case?
You know, I think obviously people are going to be watching out for that. But because Britain has secured a deal with the EU, because they won't be crashing out into nothing, but instead entering a transition period, I think those concerns are largely quelled, at least for now. It doesn't mean that obviously there isn't a ton of work to be done once they've left the EU. There is going to be, you know, another ticking clock once this transition period ends.
Let's discuss the particulars of trade for this new era. One of the big issues that U.S. officials have spoken out about recently is the digital services tax. Can you explain what that is?
Britain has proposed levying a 2% tax on American tech companies such as Google, Apple, Facebook, and Amazon. And the U.S., unsurprisingly, isn't a fan of this tax. It calls it arbitrary and discriminatory. France actually also tried to level a similar tax, but the U.S. threatened to impose retaliatory tariffs on French cheese and champagne. So France has actually backed down on that proposal, at least until the end of this year. Britain, however, seems to be pressing on with that, despite the fact that at Davos, U.S. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin said that the U.S. would consider imposing retaliatory tariffs on British car makers. For the moment, Britain is pressing ahead with it, with the idea that this tax would be ready by April, but it seems like both countries are still kind of discussing that.
Two other trade issues that seem to be somewhat contentious between the U.S. and U.K. are healthcare and meat. Why are those areas so complicated?
Yeah, these are two of the kind of controversial topics that come up when we talk about a potential U.S.-U.K. trade deal. With healthcare, the biggest concern is around Britain's healthcare service, which is the NHS, and whether a trade deal could possibly incorporate greater U.S. pharmaceutical company access to the NHS. The fear here in Britain being that a trade deal could somehow result in medicine being more expensive. The other issue is the chlorinated chicken debacle, which is effectively about food standards in the trade talks and whether Britain would be willing to reduce theirs to allow access for U.S. beef and chicken. At the moment, Britain, as a member of the EU, at least until tomorrow, abides by European food standards, which bans chlorine-washed chicken from its markets. The argument that U.S. trade negotiators will likely be making during the trade talks is that they want access to British markets and would therefore be asking Britain to alter their food standards.
I mean, all of this, I guess, begs the question, is the UK now a smaller, more diminished trade combatant on the world stage?
I mean, no doubt Britain leaving this massive 28-member trading bloc will put it in a weaker leverage position. That said, I think it would be wrong to presume that the UK is necessarily going to bend to every concession that the US asks for. I think we've already seen, both with this digital services tax, but also in a number of other issues, foreign policy and otherwise, that Britain is really trying to demonstrate that, you know, it has its positions, that it's going to try to stick to them. We saw this with the Huawei decision this week to allow the Chinese tech firm into its 5G network. We also saw this with Britain's decision to seek an extradition of Anne Sekulis, the wife of the British diplomat, who was involved in a deadly car crash of a British teenager here, Henry Dunn. So, you know, we're seeing instances where Britain is pushing back as though they are kind of, you know, on sort of an equal playing field.
Does this mean that many of these trade stances we're seeing Boris Johnson having to appease his base, even at the expense of angering the Trump administration?
I mean, he's definitely balancing kind of a tight rope at the moment. On the one hand, yes, he wants this trade deal. It's all they've talked about throughout this Brexit process. But on the other hand, he needs to do what he believes is best for Britain and British citizens. And he also has to sort of maintain a good relationship with President Trump without hugging him too closely. Because, you know, as we all know, President Trump isn't exactly a popular figure here in the UK.
So Boris Johnson campaigned on getting Brexit done. Is that what happens this Friday?
In terms of leaving the EU, yes, Britain will leave, but by no means does that mean that Brexit will be done. I mean, this second phase, figuring out trade deals, both with the EU and the rest of the world, that's where the real work begins.
Historian Simon Sharma called this one of the darkest days in British history. On the other hand, Brexit proponent Nigel Farage called it the point of no return, waved flags, and is gloating. This is sort of his moment. How are regular people marking this moment?
It's going to be a day of mixed emotion for people who have been waiting for this for years. This is their moment. This is their Independence Day, as they're calling it. For people who have spent the last few years trying to stave off Britain's departure from the EU, this is obviously marks an end to that struggle. It's a day of lament, but you probably won't see too many British political figureheads making too much of a fuss tomorrow.
Yasmin Serhan is a London-based staff writer at The Atlantic. Thanks so much for joining me, Yasmin.
Thank you.
And listeners, we want to hear from you. How are you feeling about Brexit? What hopes or concerns do you have for the EU in the coming months? Leave us a voicemail at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 1-877-869-8253. This is The Takeaway. This Friday, the new movie The Assistant, written and directed by Kitty Green, hits theaters. It follows a low-level assistant at a film company run by a Harvey Weinstein-like figure. Here's Julia Garner, who stars in the film, in a scene with an HR representative played by Matthew McFadden.
Where do you want to be in 5 to 10 years?
Oh, I want to produce. I want to be a producer.
You do?
Yeah.
That's excellent. We could use more women producers. You know, it's a tough job, but I can see that you've got what it takes.
Thanks.
So why are you in here trying to throw it all away over this bull?
At this year's Sundance Film Festival, The Assistant was one of several new narrative and documentary films grappling with how to put Me Too on the big screen. Allison Wilmore, film critic at Vulture and New York Magazine, is on the line with us today from Sundance in Park City, Utah. Hi, Allison.
Hi.
You wrote in your review that this is the first great movie about Me Too. What sets it apart from some of the others?
Well, I think that what's so interesting about The Assistant is that it understands that maybe an abusive figure is less psychologically interesting than all of the systems that prop that person up and enable him and accommodate him. And it really focuses on how something like this can become the norm. You know, it shows a whole workspace that is just based around rationalizing for someone's behavior.
So The Assistant was inspired by Harvey Weinstein, but the character based on him is never shown on screen. Was that a smart choice?
I think so. You know, he becomes this kind of black hole around which everyone else in the workplace seems to orbit. And I think it just really forces you to look at his behavior from a more systemic viewpoint, because you really have to be like, how does someone get away with behaving like this for so long? And it's because you know, this main character really wants desperately to have his career. Other people laugh it off. Other people have endured it and so kind of see it as hazing almost. I think it's a really psychologically interesting movie about a phenomenon that I think we have really been reckoning with since these stories started breaking.
When I think about a movie like Bombshell, which sort of was set in the in Fox News, you had men and women, people like Jeanine Pirro, who are essentially enabling the system. What about this movie? How does it tackle the institutional systemic issues in workplace environments?
Well, it really underscores the idea that you can't really separate out sexual abuse in these contexts and sexual harassment from just abuse of power in general. You know, you see this character who is just humiliated in various ways. The one time you hear from the Harvey Weinstein stand-in, it's on the phone when he's just like hissing abuse at her, which is something he was famous for, you know? And so it really just shows you how you get so used to kind of dealing with and expecting that kind of behavior as normal. You just stop speaking up, you know? You just come up with a warped idea of what workplaces are.
Do you get a sense of how Hollywood is reacting to this film?
You know, it's funny to be here at Sundance, where the film played, it's out in theaters now, because so many people here, you know, worked with Weinstein or dealt with him in some way. He used to be all over this festival. I think that it's a small film, but I think it gets at some truths that people really appreciate. And it's certainly only one of a bunch of movies that are here at the festival this year that are dealing with feelings about Me Too.
You also recently reviewed Promising Young Women, another new film dealing with sexual assault. How does this film grapple with the issues at the core of Me Too?
Well, Promising Young Woman is essentially a story of like a Me Too vigilante, you know, played by Carey Mulligan. She goes out to bars and pretends to be incredibly drunk and alone and sees what happens when she gets picked up by someone who, you know, says that they're trying to help her, but inevitably attempt to take advantage of her. And it's a very stylized, blackly funny movie, but there is this real core of anger to it that I think is kind of fascinating. It's definitely about the idea of having righteous anger for having dealt with these things for so long, but also about what happens, how you move on or don't.
On the Record is a documentary about some of the women who accused Russell Simmons, the music producer, of sexual assault. Had its premiere also at Sundance. But then there was some behind-the-scenes drama when Oprah Winfrey stepped away as the EP, the executive producer of the project. Is it clear why she took her name off?
No, you know, that's really one of the big mysteries of this festival. The film's allegations are ones that have already come out. They were in the New York Times. They, you know, went through the whole fact-checking process in the New York Times. I think that, you know, Oprah Winfrey also recently, with the Michael Jackson documentary, obviously dealt with a lot of abuse. I've seen some of the accusers from the documentary speak about how maybe she just didn't want to have to deal with that again. But I think that, you know, it's such a shame that she has made this film controversial by pulling away from it, because I think it really puts the women who've spoken up in it in this really difficult place. You know, she said that she believes them, but also that she has doubts about the story that's put on the screen. And I think that's kind of an impossible middle ground to try and remain on.
So you've seen a bunch of films that have been made in the wake of Me Too. Do you think documentary is more effective at telling these stories than narrative features?
I think that they approach the stories in different ways. You know, there's a film here about, it's called Happy, Happy, Joy, Joy. It's a documentary about Ren and Stimpy. And the filmmakers had actually finished a version when the story about the creator, John Crisfalusi, broke in BuzzFeed News. And then they found themselves in a place of having to remake the movie in a lot of ways, to re-edit it, to do new interviews. Suddenly they had a movie that was about something different than what they had started. So I think that there is something to do with documentaries about the kind of immediacy of how they're able to respond to ideas about Me Too and like are changing kind of public images of, say, you know, these difficult geniuses and, you know, people who actually, there's more to that story. So I think that in that case, we're seeing a quicker turnaround for docs. And that's why we're seeing these big stories surrounding docs.
When it comes to depicting these kinds of stories on screen, are there particular stories that you haven't seen yet, but you really want filmmakers to tackle?
I think we're just getting started. You know, I think it's been interesting to see a few of the narrative films here, including Promising Young Woman, be about the idea of whether you just let anger, no matter how justified, consume you, or whether how you kind of try and move on about reconciliation. And I am really interested in seeing stories about that as well, you know, as we kind of have more and more conversations about what happens next after all of these stories that many people knew about that were open secrets are finally brought to light. I think I want to see how women kind of live their lives in the wake of trauma and how, you know, you pick up the pieces. And I think those are stories that we're going to see more of going forward.
I certainly do wonder if we'll ever see a movie about Roman Polanski, given that he actually pled guilty to statutory rape years ago, but it's regularly received standing ovations from his adoring peers in Hollywood. What do you think?
You know, I think that Me Too has changed a lot, but I don't think, for all that it has felt seismic, I don't think it's also brought about the kind of degree of changes that sometimes we hope. So I think, you know, we're still waiting to see how these stories will come for some people.
Allison Wilmore is a film critic at Vulture and New York Magazine. Thanks so much, Allison.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our show for today. Quick shout out to the team who makes this audio extravaganza every single day. Alexandra Botti is our senior producer, and she leads our producer squad. Ethan Oberman, Jackie Martin, Jivika Varma, Jose Olivares, Andres O'Hara, Meg Dalton, and Lydia McMullen-Laird. Claire McKean and Debbie Daughtry are our board ops. Jay Cowett is our director and sound designer, and our digital editor is Polly Irungu. David Gable is our executive assistant and $7 million man.
Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology.
Special thanks to Lee Hill. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Arun Venugopal. Amy Walter is in the chair tomorrow as normal, and I'm back with you on Monday. We'll see you then. This is The Takeaway.